Hey, everybody. Welcome to Comedy Filmers, episode 486.
Feels pretty good, 486. We're getting so close.
Mm-hmm. We've done 99 spoiler eps.
Mm-hmm. And these are just ones that are numbered. There's extra ones in there that, yeah. I mean, we're probably already at like 800. So.
We're just throwing around math, yeah, just crazy, yeah, willy-nilly stuff.
Well, there's 200 episodes we never released.
So that's right. The
I want to see those.
Yeah. The secret tapes.
Yeah.
Right on.
We had a podcast, Speakeasy. We don't like to talk about it, but yeah.
Are those going to be unearthed in a vault like 20 years from now?
They are, yeah. On a thumb drive.
On a thumb drive, someone's just going to find, oh. Yeah.
Oh, my God, the lost episodes
the
of
lost,
Comedy Film
The
Nerd.
Lost thumb drive. Yeah. The Film Nerd thumb drive.
Wow.
That's floating around.
They're talking about all the original Hulu movies.
I see why they didn't release these. The episodes really weren't that great. They should have just kept the
same. Yeah, it makes sense. It was a good editorial decision.
Yeah, they maybe should have just deleted them and saved all of us time.
So, well, let's introduce our guest. First time guest.
Filmmaker. A filmmaker. I was introduced to this gentleman through Jill Stein when she came to our show.
On the show, Win Jill Stein's Money?
Win Jill Stein's Money, yes, which is a fantastic show. She does questions about election fraud and she being the first author of the Green New Deal. And
that would be
money.
A great show, though.
Who's the director of the documentary Revolution Televised? Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Ranka.
Hello, thank you. Happy to be here.
So why don't you tell us, Kevin, a little bit about, I watched, it's a five-part series on YouTube, but also you can get it as a Blu-ray, your doc that's available, the Revolution Televised, which basically goes into what happened in the 2016 election.
Yeah, so the documentary sets out to prove a slightly different, the documentary sets out to prove a slightly different perspective than what the mainstream media has given us, not only by how we ended up with a president like Donald Trump, but the massive role the corrupt media and Democratic establishment played in that. Mm-hmm. But there's also positive and elements to the film too. You know, seeing the uprising of progressives being one of the, you know, the big values of the film. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a story a lot of people didn't get to see because, you know, as we had discussed before, there is, you know, six companies that have come to own all of what's played on television, basically.
Right.
They own 90%. So our sea of information has changed rapidly. So, and in the same way, you know, the film industry is a little bit like that, too. You've covered that, Graham, on your show, The Political Vigilante, that it functions sometimes as a bit of a long arm of the establishment. So we felt that the right thing to do would be to make a story that I think a lot of people weren't getting to see, which is, I think, the main story of 2016, which is progressives finally waking up in this incredible way and just this uprising that was happening that was finally challenging that. So
yeah, it was interesting.
Where is it? It's on
so
YouTube.
You can watch it on YouTube, all five episodes for free, and then the Blu-rays, I have to say, they look a lot nicer. You know, it's nice. I'm not just saying that because they cost money.
Narrated by Viggo Mortensen. So how did you get, I mean, he's a pretty sizable name. How did you get that guy to narrate your doc? Because we couldn't get him for earbuds.
Oh, yeah. we had shot the whole doc. I'd just written the screenplays, which took an absurd amount of time and quite a bit of Adderall, I'll be honest with you, to write these. I mean, I'd done like hundreds of drafts.
Are they one of your sponsors, Adderall?
They are. But no, and so in doing this, we wrote these scripts. I think we did like 100 drafts because I had to alter the language a lot, being very far left. I think you still owe it to your audience to be honest, so you're not just making propaganda, even if you do believe you're telling the truth. So some of the early drafts were pretty intense, and I think that I had some writers come in and say, you know, maybe you shouldn't be saying some of these things, so, you know, let the audience make these decisions. But we started reaching out to a lot of activists and celebrity narrators. Our first narrator option we were hoping for was actually Pam Grier, you know, the blaxploitation actress from Foxy Brown, and she never answered us. You know, we were crushed by that. That would have been a dream. But then we tried, this is nothing against Viggo, it's more so we didn't think we'd get him. We tried Danny Glover, Mark Ruffalo, and Viggo was like a last shot Hail Mary. And I remember coming home from school and checking my email, and there's just this email that says like, "Yo, it's me, Viggo." Like, it was just like that brief, and I was just like, no way. And it was like a stage process. He was like, you know, send me the scripts. Like, I want to see what this is all about. Send me some still images. And you know, next thing you know, he's like rewriting some of the scripts, which I thought was great. And he's giving a lot of input. And yeah, he said, I'll do it. The thing that people ask, like, how'd you get him? I think the big thing in this industry, believe it or not, is honesty attracts honesty. If you want to deal with some of these kind of like fake or, you know, the part of the industry I don't like, which is just about, you know, elitism and stuff. But if you're honest with an honest person, they appreciate that. So Viggo was surprised by me saying, like, I have no money to pay you. I have nothing to give you to do this, but I really think it'd be a great project. Mm-hmm. And he reacted well to that.
Well, yeah, you know, what did Bill Murray do? He fired his agents and managers and just set up a phone number.
Oh, I love that.
You just call and leave a message. He may or may not answer you.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that the greatest?
It's kind of a great idea, I think.
Mm-hmm. And like, I think he just has like an agent comes in and negotiates the fine points of the contract or something if you hire him, which is pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's great because he can kind of hear you, but he doesn't have to engage if he doesn't want to. Yep. Like, it's just a one-way kind of thing.
Yep.
It's brilliant. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to set up a Comedy Film Nerds 180.
So, Graham, you saw a movie I have been really wanting to see. I didn't get a chance to yet. El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie. And what I loved about this is that, again, we always talk about the trailers. Trailers did not give anything away. And even the descriptions, like, it was a great movie to go in blind if you're a fan of the show because you didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So how did you like it, first of all?
It was.
And you were a fan of the show, I'm guessing.
I was a huge fan of the show. Mm-hmm. I'm just now learning that Robert Forster died, which really bums me out.
Oh, you didn't know that? Oh, yeah, yeah.
He just passed away, I guess.
Yeah, very recent.
Me and my wife were watching it, and he died like that long before that. Mm-hmm. It was shocking.
Well, all the more reason to see this movie because he's great. Mm-hmm. I love the series. I watch Better Call Saul. So when I heard this was coming out, I was like, all right, you know, first of all, great excuse to go back and watch the last season.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I watched like the last five or six episodes, which I would recommend doing if you haven't. I haven't seen the last season since it came out, which was whatever, 3-4 years ago, maybe.
So I was late to the party on that, so I actually saw the entire thing more recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, like, I think I just watched like the last season, like last year.
That's a good thing, though. I would tell you, waiting for that week by week was brutal when it was airing.
Yes,
unbelievable.
In some ways, you might have done it right.
Yeah, totally.
Because it was like, so there's great stuff in it. So if you watch Better Call Saul. It always starts with an older Saul working in a Cinnabon in some mall, right? So if you go back and watch one of the last episodes, Saul is like, look, man, if I do witness protection or whatever, I'm going to be working at a Cinnabon in Omaha.
He like forewarns it.
So they're like, oh, that's where, I guess we know he's over in Omaha.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie picks up from one of the last scenes in the series is Jesse escaping because he was in
a meth slave.
Neo-Nazis made him a meth slave, and he gets in this El Camino and escapes, and he's just like half crazed because he's been tortured, and he's just like screaming, crying, joy, every emotion, all, and he just escapes. So it literally picks up after that.
Right.
And this is all in the trailer, but he goes to his two buddies, those two like knucklehead meth buddies.
Was it
Badger and
Skinny Pete?
Skinny Pete. So this El Camino brings back a lot of those Robert Forster's back in it. It brings back, and he does a lot of flashbacks, even with Cranston, which is cool.
Right.
Flashbacks, basically, you know, a lot of it expanding on what happened while he was being tortured and being a meth slave.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So it really shows, and that guy, you know, Todd, that Eric, that character actor from Friday Night Lights, Jesse Plemons.
Oh, man. You know what was kind of great?
So creepy, that guy, that character.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
What was kind of great was a lot of people, like, they didn't age like a day. I mean, Jesse looked like he did not age at all. But that guy put on, because he had to do a role, I think, around that time where he put on like 50 pounds. So he's a big boy in that. It does not, like, it's not even plausible in the flashbacks that could be the same person. But it kind of works. His physicality reminds you of, like, Orson Welles in, like, Touch of Evil. Like, it's disturbing. He's like a big, hefty guy now, and he's really creepy. I mean, that was... He actually worked pretty well, I thought.
That character, especially going back and watching the last season and then seeing El Camino, it is chilling how boy next door he is as a sociopath.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just, hey, no hard feelings, then blows someone's mm-hmm. head off.
He they expanded that a lot in the new movie in a great way. Like, I thought maybe he would, because we only saw a bit of him. I wondered if he was like that and then suddenly just would do, like, you know, I thought maybe he might, like, attack Jesse or something after being friendly, but he didn't. And that was even more unsettling. He was really acting like his friend. I mean, it's really unsettling. It's really complex, I thought.
And that, I mean, there's this, I don't want to, like, spoil too much, but there's just,
no spoilers.
Oh, shit.
you see, there's this part revealed about, you know, Todd's life that Jesse has to go into his apartment and help out with. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Is it...
My jaw dropped.
It's so horrifyingly creepy. And he just still plays this, like, aw, shucks, mm-hmm. with all of this evil crap. I mean, there's this... I'll say this. He's got a pet tarantula, and in this... you know, whatever you...
Terrarium,
yeah. There mm-hmm. you go. He's got, like, a man and a woman, like, dolls in there. It's so creepy. It is so creepy.
That. Yeah, there's a stillness to everything. Yeah. Yes. There's a stillness and sort of... It's just like a
kudos
calmness.
To the production designer.
Yeah, it was great. Mm-hmm.
Well, they did the thing that was interesting, having literally just watched it mm-hmm. the last season, the lighting, it looked differently. They shot it a little differently because mm-hmm. this was more... Jesse's POV coming out of this nightmare versus, you know, Breaking Bad was always sort of Walt's view.
Yeah, it was like almost too like neo-Western or something, you know what I mean? And I felt like this wasn't quite as, I mean, it still had like elements of that, I think. But no, yeah, I agree with you. Jesse's story was a little different than Walt's. His perspective's different. So I think it was really smart to do a slightly different visual. But it still felt like it was a part of like...
Yeah.
Like, so it didn't feel extraneous. It felt like it was a fun wrap-up story that felt like, oh, they didn't need to do that. You didn't get that impression.
No, I really mm-hmm. liked it. And this mm-hmm. is my nitpicking, Kevin. I'm curious to hear what you think.
Yeah, I
want to
hear this too.
So the one mm-hmm. thing, there was some scenes that were really long and methodical. And I was like, oh... So Vince Gillian wrote and directed it. Mm-hmm. And
did you see the X-Files Easter egg in there?
No.
Yeah, Vince Gillian, when Jesse opens the glove compartment in the car, there's a pack of Morley cigarettes. Mm. That's the brand the cigarette-smoking man smoked in the X-Files, where Vince Gilligan contributed in writing and directing many times.
Oh.
Impressed if somebody caught that. I was so enamored by what was happening, I think I just missed it.
Wow.
That's pretty clever.
That's a great Easter egg.
I do love the X-Files.
There was just some scenes that were super long and really drawn out, which was, you know, that's fine in a series where you've got 13 episodes or whatever to tell this story. So you can take a scene that should probably be 30 to 60 seconds and make it 3-4 minutes because you're drawing out and you're giving backstory and you're painting a picture. There's a couple times where I was like, yeah, this is a 2-hour movie that you probably could have trimmed 10, 15 minutes out of. Again, mm-hmm. this is me nitpicking. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I loved it and I thought it was cool. So Kevin, what did you think of like the pacing and stuff?
I think generally it worked, but I do think you could have lost 20 minutes. My thing was actually, my critique was a little different. I felt like it was like, sometimes it seems a little too easy for Jesse. I know the counterpoint to that could be he had it so hard the final season that you know we didn't want to see him go through much more. But at the same time, like things for me just felt a little convenient sometimes, like screenwriter convenient. I think it makes sense because when you have a guy in his, you know, as soon as the story starts, or Vince Gilligan had to write that script, he had to be thinking like, how could he outrun, you know, every cop, you know, the DEA? Like this is going to be very impossible to make feel like possible. And I think like you have to give Jesse some of those gimme moments where something sort of conveniently happens, but I think it might have happened one or too many times maybe. But overall, I think that's a small thing for me because I also think he might have been right in that I don't know if I really did want to see Jesse go through like a whole lot more
pain. Couldn't
I think that mm-hmm. so I think that was the mm-hmm. that was the move, and I think it was right.
I agree with that too. There's a couple times I was like, oh, come on,
yeah, this really? Exactly.
But then it was like, you know, watching the last season, there was some stuff in the last season where I was like, is this, like, some of the shit Hank did in the last season, like, there's no way the fucking DEA, like, he's mm-hmm. so off the reservation. Come on.
Yeah, right.
Totally.
But, you know, overall, you forgive it because the whole series was so amazing.
Right.
And, you know, like, in the last episode where, you know, Walt comes back to visit Skylar, and he starts saying, look, I did it. And she goes, I don't want to hear you did it for you. I don't want to hear that. He goes, I didn't. I did it for me.
Yeah.
I like the money and the power. Yeah. And it was like, oh, wow, that was awesome.
That moment's incredible.
And the thing I remember, too, and I remember this when I saw it the first time, but watching it again this past week, everybody's ego cost them in the final season. Jesse could have gotten away the first time, and he didn't. He's like, Walt can't get away with it. And when he comes back, it's awful what happens. That woman, he gets tortured, like all this awful. Same thing with Hank. He's finally got him, and he should have called tribal police, the thing he said, and called for backup. He didn't. He called his wife to brag.
That's a good point.
And there was no back. You know what I mean? Like he took, did all, everybody's ego cost them. Walt's ego, everyone.
Yeah, even like Todd and the other guy, Jack. It's
their greed. Everybody's greed and ego.
Skylar
Gus,
too. Yeah. Skylar too.
Mm-hmm. Everybody. Mike. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody's greed and ego cost them their lives. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
It was so well put together, that show.
Another thing I noticed too, especially watching, so I mean the whole series, Walt is, he's like playing this Heisenberg force, this figure, which I think Heisenberg was what, like a World War II era like chemist or something like that. And he's like playing a criminal basically, and then he becomes a criminal, and then, you know, he kind of gets pretty good at it. But what I think's interesting is the final antagonist they put Walt up against isn't the cartel. It's like, it's kind of an interesting parallel to Walt. I mean, Jack is kind of everything Walt kind of isn't. I mean, he's an unapologetic criminal. You know, he doesn't feel bad for the things. There is no moral quandary there. He is really, to me, the opposite side of the spectrum of what Walt, and he's a neo-Nazi. So I think, you know, there's some overlap of like, you know, like the Heisenberg and the shaved head and the beard, kind of like what Walt was, you know, I think, again, pretending to be. But the same with Jesse. Jesse and Todd are like these great parallels too, I think, because I always thought of Jesse almost like Walt's son in a lot of ways, or the son he never had. So I think, and Jack was clearly like a fatherly figure, and that those were just great antagonist forces, because Todd was the opposite of Jesse too. Jesse had such a moral quandary between being a criminal or trying to be a good person and trying to, you know, justify, and Todd had no qualms about just doing savage things for their own means. So I thought the finale was brilliant in that way.
Yeah, and the other thing too that was good about El Camino is Jesse clearly, he's like, no greed in this life. He's like, I just need just enough to get out of here. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want anything, because he's like, I chase the money. It's awful. I want out.
Right.
Because he saw what that brought to everybody, including himself.
Right.
And there's a great scene in there with Robert Forrester where he's like, you know, believe me, nobody regrets not ditching the first time more than me. And there's just great scenes with everybody, and you also meet some new people, like the welding people and that kind of stuff, which I thought was
really, that actor a lot. Yeah. I've only seen him in the new Righteous Gemstones with Danny McBride. I'd never seen that actor before, but he's getting kind of popular, and I actually really like him. I don't know, he's got this weird voice. It's like, he's a pretty good actor. He was a pretty good antagonist. You know, he wasn't like a super villain kind of thing, or like a larger than life, you know, empire type character. But I thought he was pretty great as like a person. What I liked about it was it was an epilogue. It felt like a final chapter in a book or something. You know, you might read like a Cormac McCarthy book, and there's just this like last chapter that I think does tie some things together. But it was kind of different that they wasn't playing with the heavy themes that I think Breaking Bad kind of presented. It was kind of an after chapter, and I think it did.
Well, epilogue's probably a good way to describe it.
Yeah, it gives Jesse
from a novel.
It gives Jesse like a lot of these, just, he just thrown in a lot of situations, and his survival is his only, you know, and I think that's a great place to put a character like him. I almost could detach it in that way of just watching Jesse keep getting set up with a new situation that was totally back against the wall. And that's some of the best moments of Breaking Bad. Like when they had to have that bald guy get arrested, you know, I think all these crazy situations they'd get in that would have me like hugging the pillow on my couch because I was so, you know, on the edge of my seat, nervous. I think, you know, the new movie cranked that up and did a really good job with that. And let Jesse do it without Walt's help. I mean, he proved himself, I think. You know, my wife was saying, like, he's so smart now. I said, yeah, I mean, he went through years of hanging out with Walter White and doing these things.
He's going to pick something up.
Yeah, he's evolved.
Well, there's, and that's a great point, because there's a great scene in the last season where he's talking to Hank and Hank's partner, and he's like, you guys have no idea. Whatever you think it's going to go, he will outsmart you, and it will go the opposite. He will win. He is smarter than everyone. Like, it was just,
I forgot about
like, it was such a great scene. I forgot about it too. So that did, I was like, he worked with the best, the most devious, insane, criminally brilliant mind.
Yep, one step ahead.
One step ahead of everybody. I mean, it's just the shit, like, too, of, you know, Walt still in the last season when he needed to, playing that fake Walter White. Oh, geez, I'm just one of Jesse's pals. Do you know where he's around? You know, just, oh, shucks.
Oh, man, that
all of his fumbling lies. Well, you know, crazy thing happened. I'm at the gas pump, and there's, his whole family's looking at him like, stop lying. Yeah. You know, so brilliant.
Oh, yeah, I love the scene where he comes into the car wash when and he gets that text from Jesse or whatever, and he goes to like the soda machine. He tells Skylar like, "Oh, I got to go fix the soda machine." He like pulled, you know, he reached in there and pulled out a pistol. It's like that kind of encapsulates this sort of all shucks, Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, and then he always plays this like, "Oh, darn it."
Yeah. I mean, Vince Gilligan always said it's like, you know, it's hard to have a series that's basically, you know, centers around a villain, you know, somebody that's doing horrible things all the time. But he said the key is if the character's not likable, they have to be interesting.
Right.
So if this, he said, the last thing, the biggest sin we could have done is if Walter White ever became not interesting, then the show would be over.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that was the thing with that was so brilliant point about the writing and the arc of the series was it started out, man, he was likable. Right. And you mm-hmm. you were like, I get it. He's got cancer. What is he? You know, oh, darn it. You know, there's all these memes on social media like, if we had free health care, he never would have killed all these people. There wouldn't have been blue meth that's all so over funny. Albuquerque. So it's like, and it started as this like, which I love. I love this type of anti-hero or whatever of like, God, what would I do? If I had 6 months to live and a baby on the way and I could make a bunch of money in a short amount of time, Jesus.
Because it started for him like, I need money for my family. How it started. Yeah. And then I love how it transformed into something far different.
Yes.
And then he admitted it at the end. No, I did it for me.
I think that's a great.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point. That's what I really like about the show is I think it did lure audiences in thinking it was going to be another show where the writer works very hard to create this justifiable character. But I think in the middle of the show, it kind of dodges and goes the other way. Where like, if you're still identifying with Walt at a certain point, I think some people miss the show entirely. Like if the last season, like, oh, but if this was me, I don't think Vince Gilligan, I think he meant to bring you into that world that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think along the way, you were supposed to stop thinking maybe like, what if I was Walt and start really dissecting internally, like how you feel about, you know, the morality of what he is doing as opposed to how you would handle. Because I mean, at a certain point, it's hard to root for Walt, even though I still did as sick as it is.
He did everything from like kill people to poison his girlfriend, you know, poison Jesse's
die hard Walter
kids.
White supporters by the end remind me of like Trump supporters. You're like, oh, but he did that. But, you know, this is like, yeah, but dude.
Trump never lies.
Yeah. It's like, come on, man.
Like, Walter White. Yeah, sure.
One thing I think Vince Gilligan did too, as I think good screenwriters do, is look, if you're going to make a character who does a lot of bad things, make them fucking really good at what they do.
Yeah.
I mean, he made
yeah.
the primo meth just like Tony Soprano was pretty phenomenal being the Don of
remember
yeah. New Jersey.
Remember that
like,
first scene when he made it and he went Jesse goes, this is glass grade, like I've never even seen meth this right. good before. So here's an interesting thing about the production and the licensing, because you know Breaking Bad, not a Netflix show, an AMC show, but Breaking Bad made this movie, so they made a deal with AMC where this movie, it'll live on Netflix but it'll go to AMC later. So if you don't have Netflix and you have AMC, you'll see it.
Mm-hmm. I actually like that a lot because I'm not a massive fan of Netflix's, you know, putting out thousands of projects a year and passion projects for people who frankly, you know, like nobody wants to see a Chris Kattan or like a, I don't know, like a Ashton Kutcher, you know, his passion project. I think teaming up with companies like AMC that have a track record of making good work and you know, allowing them to make things that they normally wouldn't. Like, I don't think AMC would have on their own made a Breaking Bad movie. I think they would have been too much of a risk.
Right.
Not only
That's
tarnishing
a good point
yeah,
too,
well, not
yeah.
only tarnishing the brand, but you know,
it was a good partnership.
Yeah, yeah, cuz I mean, what Breaking Bad got maybe $2 million per episode or something like that. And mostly, I mean, a lot of that went to film because it was shot on film. But
I'm sure the bulk, you know, if not all of the budget was provided by Netflix too.
Yeah, which was, I mean, they have enough money to do anything.
Sony, who owns the Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm. Do they? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Sony owns the Sony. So yeah, and I like that too because, and we've talked about this before on this show, like we're in a whole new era, a whole new world with streaming, like get rid of the old business models. Come up with something interesting, and for AMC and Netflix, to, like, why not? You guys get it first. We'll get it later.
Yep.
Absolutely.
HBO, in a weird way, did that with Sesame Street. They bought Sesame Street.
Yep, that's right.
But you know, the PBS and Children's Broadcasting, like, well, you can't take it away. We still have a lot of people who can't afford HBO. So the new episodes go on HBO, and then they go onto PBS after that.
I think it's a symbiotic thing. I'm curious. The biggest parallel I could think of to this is not like the Downton Abbey or whatever movie, but actually the new Sopranos movie, The Kings of Newark. I'm curious to see how that's going to be, because I feel like that's a really good comparison to El Camino as far as, like, can that sustain in today's day? It's the same, just like Vince Gilligan, same writer, director of the original Sopranos. Mm-hmm. It's got Tony's, you know, James Gandolfini's son playing him, and he looks exactly like him as a young... So, I mean, I'm curious to see how that's going to be. I think that...
A prequel? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a prequel set in the 60s in Newark during a lot of, like, the race riots.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, so we could go either way. Yeah. Seeing the El Camino trailer, I'll admit, you know, me and my wife kind of looked at each other like, this is going to be 2 hours of Jesse hiding. I mean, this is not that exciting to me. But I was so impressed with it because my expectations were so low. I was really, really impressed and very happy. So now I think maybe the Sopranos movie is going to be good too. I mean, I never thought I'd see either one of those get a follow-up film.
Well, the metrics must be very easy, much easier to predict, because they're like, all right, here's the audience for these shows. So here's the audience. It's going to be some percentage of this that we'll see this movie.
That's true.
It's so it's not going to be like a breakout hit of like, oh, I haven't seen the show, but I really like the movie. No.
These movies
are made specifically for the fans of the show.
Yeah, and they did a good job. And I was like, I don't know that I would have chosen the timeline of right after he gets out. When I heard they were making this, I just thought, is it going to be like 3-4 years down the road and he's living the new thing and then someone from his past pops up? Or
like a Lilyhammer where he's in, like, you know, Norway or somewhere living under a different name. I agree with that. I was a little surprised because I was like, am I going to even buy that it's the same day 5 years later? But I thought it was surprisingly kind of an interesting way to go about it. It was totally surprised me.
It was pretty cool.
All right, so check it out. Yeah. El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie. Only on Netflix right now until later when it'll be on AMC.
So you saw Ad Astra, Chris.
I saw Ad Astra because I wanted to see it. And also, I know the fans were like asking, like, well, has anybody seen Ad Astra yet? But it was one of those movies, too, that I got to tell you, when I watched this movie, I couldn't put my finger on what was wrong with it and why I didn't like it. Like, it was one of those weird, like, well, this has all the elements of a movie that I would like. It's hard science fiction. It's 2001, a vision of the future. It's metaphysical. It's experimental in some ways, and it's also philosophical. So that's the kind of really interesting science fiction that doesn't come along all the time. But, you know, you have movies like 2001, Interstellar, and then maybe Ad Astra is going into that wheelhouse. And then I'm watching this movie. I'm like, why am I not enjoying this film? And then it hit me. I realized it. And then when I saw the trivia, I knew exactly what had happened. Director James Gray admitted to Empire Magazine that he had to compromise with the studio on the ending of the movie to get the film greenlit, and even with major star producer like Brad Pitt on board, they still struggled for years to get it made.
Wow.
So when I saw this movie, and I had to sit with it a day or two to figure it out, and this is what it was. Imagine a movie like Interstellar, that original script that suddenly got a ton of dumb studio notes, and they were pushed onto the film, because that's exactly what this movie felt like. Imagine a movie like Interstellar, but here was the note. Okay, this isn't really accessible. You need to have long, boring monologues so Brad Pitt can tell the audience exactly what he's feeling and what he's going to do throughout the entire movie. So, and it was like worse than like the Blade Runner voiceovers. Like it was
they're horrible.
Yeah, it was worse because this was like, it was almost like, okay, this is the notes that a director would give an actor for inner dialogue. But no, we need you to say all of them out loud.
when you're bringing up that Blade Runner, if it's anything like that, where Harrison Ford's just basically saying what's happening on screen, which is the exact opposite of the point of voiceover. Yeah. Oh, that sounds terrible.
It was unbelievable to the point where I'm like, how did even Brad Pitt let this happen? Like there were literally lines of like voiceover of like, well, this is what happened to me, and my dad didn't love me. That's why I'm so closed off emotionally. And
who says that in conversation?
I know. Oh, and it was like, even if you're thinking that, why I don't need to hear it out loud.
That sounds like that synthetic Hollywood, like, execs writing notes who really haven't felt that kind of human contact, but that's what they believe it might be like.
No, because they're soulless.
It was exactly so, like, this is what I think having a soul would be like.
It was so insane, and I'm thinking, I would have loved to have seen what the original vision of this film was, because clearly, this was not it.
Well, the comparison to Interstellar, I mean, I haven't seen Ad Astra, but one of the things that I loved about Interstellar was it really made you think and go, wow, what, this was so interesting, and the way they visually depicted...
It washed over you.
It washed over you. It visually depicted multi-dimension time wow, this is so cool, and and it really and I love time travel stuff and all that stuff, but just like if you just spoon fed it to you, when I met my daughter in the future, it really made me feel like I was finally a good parent,
and the emotions
picturing
up.
Brad Pitt doing that just
like even that, like the feelings of like, or like the parallels to like Apocalypse Now and Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, where he's going to find his father out in the wilderness, who he may be still alive, he may be going crazy.
But wait, this is in space, though.
This is in space.
That's kind of interesting, where, like an Apocalypse Now.
Yes,
that almost sounds like a slam dunk to me.
Premise-wise, I was on board.
That's all you said to me? Apocalypse Now in space? Oh, I'm in.
Apocalypse Now is one of my favorite films.
Like, and you know, and he with the, you know, this weird pulse that's coming back from the father's spaceship that's causing destruction on Earth, like he has to stop that. And there's the mission, well, he's got to stop his father, but it's his father. What's he going to do? All these great dilemmas that don't go anywhere or get explored except in inner dialogue and monologue. I'm like, well, no, show me. And it even starts off with, this must have been a horrible studio. It starts off with a card. In the near future. Oof. You don't have to tell me in the near future. The production designer can tell me that in the first scene that it's in the near future. You know, humanity is blah, blah, blah. And it's like, unless you're setting up some weird, like, fantasy world that I've never been to before. Yeah, or like, Star Wars. That's fine. You can give me some cards. But, you know, in the near future, and you're telling me about astronauts and, you know, power surges, like, I can get that from the first couple scenes. Yeah, I don't need that.
Chris, though, don't you think Apocalypse Now would have been better if Martin Sheen in the voiceover went, I'm going upriver to resolve issues with my father.
You know.
Colonel Kurtz is a metaphor for my dad, who I didn't have a close relationship with.
Now imagine the card, first card, in the Vietnam era.
That's why they're in a jungle in army uniforms listening to music from the 60s.
I tell you, my experience with that, Astra, I haven't seen it, but my friend is a massive James Gray fan. I had not I've not seen his work, but I've heard from a lot of people that you know, I really trust that his work is great, and I heard they were just as disappointed as you were, as maybe somebody who hadn't seen his work. I thought when I saw the trailers it was going to be a sort of Solaris, like this sort of like heady sci-fi movie, like Tarkovsky, where it's like, it's about as non, you know, as non-studio as you can get, but still be in space and have like these existential themes. But what happens with a lot of this stuff is, I think it starts with a very pure-hearted idea, a great idea even, and a groundbreaking idea. But to make a movie in space, by very definition, you're going to need to invite investors in. It's space. You're going to need money. And the more hands that get in there, and the more hands it goes through, and the more people that want say in the film, you get this.
That's really what it felt like.
And that's why. That's such a great point, because look at the successful sci-fi space movies. It was one of these, Christopher Nolan or who did
Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick. I forget the director. Gravity was Curio.
Inarritu. Was it? It wasn't Inarritu, was it? The guy who did
Fans of Curio, wasn't it? Who did?
Quran, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had
to have their own vision.
Yep. And if the studio said maybe you should, they went, thanks.
No, thank you.
Step outside.
We got it.
We got it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the problem. If you have a director that doesn't have that much, you have to have...
Right.
I mean, there's a handful. We're talking about less than 10 directors that can come in with a big budget movie and tell the studio, no.
James Gray is a mid-level director at best.
He's a good director, but
when you look at his resume, he doesn't have that kind of clout in Hollywood.
He doesn't have it yet.
It's a shame. Kubrick, Kubrick by 2001. I mean, just imagine it. I don't know if you guys have read the screenplay, but what a phenomenal opening to a movie that just make a space movie and start with the apes, the dawn of time. I mean, and the throwing up of the throwing up of the bone So I'm new to podcasts, guys. So
it's all right.
I mean, just the transition alone, where the ape throws the bone up in the air and it turns into a
there's not a studio executive on the face of the earth that would have said yes to that.
Yeah, exactly. Right, but Kubrick did remain a little independent. I mean, he lived in England. He funded a lot of his movies through private friends and people that really loved cinema. He was lucky to have that. It's sad when a guy like James Gray essentially has to prostitute his film out because he has to make these concessions right off the bat. You almost know it's not going to be great.
We've seen this happen time and time again with really good directors that had a great indie world
and
low budget
fiction. You need such a vision for that. That's the you know, with anything genre based, it's really best when it's left alone.
Science fiction, you're right. Every great science fiction had a singular vision.
Yes.
Either the adaption of the source material was singular and the director knew how to respect that.
Right.
And or the director went, no, this is what we're doing.
Yes.
This is how we're doing it.
And there were even like these weird scenes that had to be notes too. Like there is a shot in the trailer of like there's some weird space fight on the lunar rollers and the rovers. And that's in the movie. It's long too, but it's so out of place. It's like they're on the moon. They have to get to the... You know, he's on a secret government mission, so he has to actually get to the launch area. Oh, but there's pirates. There's pirates on the moon?
Pirates.
And they're better armed than the military?
What kind of pirates are these? Like Somalian pirates? Yeah. Or like ones with like patches?
I mean, what's great. It never gets explained. There's pirates. It's like,
you're on the dark side of the moon, matey.
It's mining rights. Mining rights? Oh. But also, you're not even going to a mine. You're going to a launch area. But then we'll protect you. Like, you know, the space marines or whatever. The space marines don't protect him. Like, so the pirates are also better armed than the military getting to the launch. And why is the launch area so far away from the landing base that you have to go through pirate territory to get to it?
It sounds like they just cherry-picked all these things from successful sci-fi movies. Like, we'll take a little bit from Blade Runner, a little bit from Alien.
But that's where the studio probably came in. That's their mentality. Yeah. I've had to visit...
Needs to be more action. There has to be a space pirate fight in there.
Space pirate moon fight.
I remember for my school, we had to visit, like, the WB studio. And I don't know how I ended up on the trip because I despise a lot of the bigger budget stuff. But I wanted to see how it worked. We got to meet, you know, the owner of Warner Brothers or maybe it was Paramount, either one. And they said, you know, we were allowed to ask one question. And I asked, you know, how do you decide what movies you remake? And the answer was so like, every 20 years we kind of dig up the same. The mentality is very much what it sounds like they went through with this, where it was like, well, we don't know if audiences are going to like your vision, James Gray, but we know they like these. So why don't we just shove them in there and they won't even know. And this is like time and time again. And I hate to connect it to politics, but the same thing. They think like we're dumb. Audiences are dumber than they really are. They don't realize that the more content that drops, the more savvy they're kind of getting to like, this is garbage. I mean, not saying that this movie is garbage, but this attempt to just like shove it in or collage things that have worked before, that I think audiences do want to see a level of new things. I think this idea that they have to be things we sort of feel a relationship to, nostalgia to, or have seen before and feel comfortable with. I think audiences want to be uncomfortable. And I think a lot of movies have proven that.
Yeah.
You know?
And even with Brad Pitt as a producer, even like it was still wasn't enough to keep the initial vision.
That's so funny, man, because we all saw the trailer. We sat in this room and saw the trailer and went, it sounds like it should be good, but we all had this there's some little missing something in this trailer.
Yep. Now I know what it was.
Yeah,
it's funny you say that because I had a lot of friends that are more into the big Hollywood films, and they were saying like, you know, because there was a bunch of space movies that came out that year. There was like a Sean Penn one, and there was a Ryan Gosling one. This one looked very different, but they were saying like, do we need another one? But I was thinking, well, it's James Gray. Like, this might be the one that actually kind of matters, because the other two I felt like weren't really that impressive. But I think this one ended up being the worst one from what I've heard.
Yeah,
they're saying it's actually the worst of the space movies. It should have been the best, I think, with the team behind it. Because I'm a big believer, you have to look at the team behind a movie. You really have to. You have to dig in before it comes out. It could have a great trailer. Nowadays, they have people that can cut trailers better than some people can cut movies, because the people are sold on the trailer. So they will bring in an amazing, it almost feels like a mini film, the trailer. And I think that it can be deceptive, but at least with Adastra, I wasn't really I don't know.
It's hard to say because that's a good point about the trailers, but also we've seen, I'm sure you have, plenty of good movies that had horrible trailers.
Definitely.
Right. Yep.
Definitely.
Where the trailer completely misrepresents the film.
I
think it's because of what you're saying, Kevin, is they think the audience is too dumb, so we have to spoon feed them this trailer.
Right.
or tell them the whole story.
No, I know. You saw with Suicide Squad, arguably when a movie they think, I think when they know the movie isn't that good is when they bring in like the best trailer editor. They
buy,
they're like, this is all we can do is set. Because I mean, the Suicide Squad, everybody loved that trailer and it was like, this is going to be a great movie. And I mean, all you had to do is look at who was making it and the writer and like, this isn't going to be that good of a movie.
Right.
You got, you know, Jared Leto, you know, playing like a kind of like a wankster style, whatever. You know what I mean? It was like a very bizarre take on the Joker, but yeah, it was a movie that everyone was telling me, but the trailer's great. And I think we've become, you know, fool me once, you know, shame on you. It's kind of become clear that you can't trust the trailer anymore.
No, very true. You know? Yeah. So, all right. So yeah, it's too bad. I wanted to like this movie and it went beyond wanting to like it. I wanted it to be better. I wanted it to be a better movie. I'm sure James Gray did too.
That's a bad feeling.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I honestly feel like if there is an appetite or a director's cut that could come out of this film where he got to completely redo this entire film from start to finish, I'd like to see that version.
Like a Blade Runner where he did like five cuts and finally got it right? Yeah, I'm okay with that.
So I would actually like to see that because I think it would be a very different film.
Okay.
All right, so now, Graham, you saw In the Shadow of the Moon. This is another streaming movie, but a crime drama, right?
It's a time travel crime drama.
Oh, I didn't realize there was a... time travel.
Well, yeah, it takes place, this serial killer keeps reappearing every 9 years.
Okay.
And they try to figure it out and she doesn't age. This is all in the trailer, which I don't know. I watched the trailer and went, oh, she's time traveling.
Right.
So I like I say, I'm a sucker for a good time travel movie. And you know, we can be a little critical of some of the Netflix-only films.
We can indeed.
Because they'll just make whatever. As you were talking about, Kevin, it's why El Camino was good, is they brought in this outside team that has already done it and proven these characters. I really, this movie is a lot of fun. It's really cool. I don't want to give anyone any spoiler stuff. There's some stuff in there, and I actually like it when time travel movies do this, that make you go, well, wait a minute. If this happened and that happened, how did the... But time travel is a theory.
Right.
So there's two... There's the two most popular theories that I'm aware of are the river theory, where time is a stream and you enter it at different points and it's always flowing that way, or the string theory that they used in Quantum Leap, which is time you can... It's a ball of string, so it all touches and it's all happening at the same time.
Yeah. The future, the past, and the future. It's all just one sort of... Yeah,
yes.
That's...
It's all happening at the same time. So this one it feels like it uses more of the stream one, but there's just a thing in there where I was like, wait a minute, but in a good way, not in a like, what the f- you idiots. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, man. Like, you want to stay home and
pick a time travel theory, for God's sake. Yes.
I kind of like the title of it. I don't know anything about this movie, but I'm a sucker for titles. And The Shadow of the Moon kind of, I mean, I'd be at least interested.
Boyd Holbrook, Holbrook does a really good job. And the young woman that is Cleopatra Coleman, Michael C. Hall, that's all really good. It's a crime drama. You know, like I love a good, crime thriller, a detective movie. So it's that with time travel and a great, again, I don't want to spoil it, but a great, the time travel quandary is proposed in a way, and I would love to hear what other people have to say about what they proposed in this movie. You know, so that was really, I don't want to say any more because it'll give it away. But like, this is, if you want to stay home and watch a good Netflix film, this was it.
Did it remind you at all? There was a 70s movie, I think, called Time After Time, where H.G. Wells chased Jack the Ripper through time.
Oh, yeah.
It's Final Countdown about Pearl Harbor?
The aircraft carrier, yeah.
I haven't seen that.
Both of those deal with actual historical events, Jack the Ripper and Pearl Harbor. This doesn't deal with an actual one. It proposes one in the future. And so that's the thing I liked about both of those movies is it made you go, well, shit, what if we could, you know, in Final Countdown, they're like, well, if we can send a modern day aircraft carrier to stop the Japanese, should we? Well, should we let World War II play out?
Twilight Zone's done some stuff with that, too. That's phenomenal. Yeah. Serling, I think his first teleplay was something like to that nature, and I like that. Mm-hmm. And I like the often the sort of twist that like there's nothing you really can do, or it makes something arguably worse. Even like the Ray Bradbury story where the guy steps on the butterfly, thinking, you know.
Delicate Sound of Thunder.
Yeah, yeah, Delicate Sound. I do like that a lot.
I actually can't believe I knew exactly what
was that.
Impressive. I was blanking, but
like, you saved Aaron a minute and a half of Googling.
That's great. I did have a question. Is this like a primer kind of approach, which was a very like, even if you've seen that was like a $10,000 time travel movie that was pretty pretty minimalist and kind of a thriller.
Basically, the effect was a box.
Yeah, but it was really like heady with the actual theory part, which I think totally confused me. I mean, I was lost.
This one is more. It's not so much heady with the theory so much as it is. They do a good job of like, I don't know where it's going. I'm really trying to figure this out. And so it's really more, its foundation is a crime drama. It's a detective tracking somebody down. And why are they, and you know, people think he's crazy and this, that, and the other thing. And that carries it. And sort of the time travel stuff is sort of, comes in a little later. I mean, it's like not the B plot, but it's like he's solving a crime. It's a detective solving a crime at its core, which I like, that has time travel in it.
I like the cross-pollination of like things that aren't normally matched up. I mean, we have seen time travel thrillers before. There's one I really love from a few years ago called, I think, Time Crimes. I don't know if you've ever seen that. Mm-hmm. You have seen that by a Hispanic director? It's a Spanish one. That's something else. But I will say this. My thing with Netflix movies is they feel like content sometimes more than I think they feel like movies or films. They don't give me the same satisfaction. They give me more the satisfaction of watching like an hour-long doc on YouTube or something, which is nothing wrong with that. I just think they feel different, and they both have their own validity. Did this feel like a movie to you, or did this feel like content?
It felt like a movie, and that's such a great delineation. The movies that I feel fail are, like you say, they just bought it, or they spent $10-20 million on this movie, or they just, it was at a, you know, it was out, no one else wanted to buy it, so they just scooped it up, you know, and put it out there to fill content, whereas this felt like, I almost wish I could have seen this on a big screen. Not that it had amazing visual effects or anything like that, but it was a big movie story.
That sounds good. That sounds good. I'm going to watch it with my wife, and I hope you're telling the truth, because if it's a bad movie, I'm going to blame it on you, Grammy. I get a lot of trouble when a movie's bad. My wife does not like to waste her time because she works so hard and she loves film. So if I put something on that's trash,
I'll just blame me.
Yeah. It was Graham. He swore it was good. Yeah.
So Graham, we got some Patreon sponsors.
Chris, that delights me no end.
Yeah, we've got, we are at almost maximum capacity for Patreon
subscribers. Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone who's been supporting us. Even though we've announced the ending of the show in December, it's
Really you guys have stuck with us for the end, so we really appreciate that.
Really appreciate it.
Johnny Rulon, guess what? He's got some short horror stories for sale.
Johnny, thank you so much for having short horror stories.
He's got, one's called The Shell. It's a Lovecraftian tale about a neighborhood that loses power and becomes victim to an unknown monster. The second is called She, about a high school held under the dark spell of an evil cult leader. They're on Amazon Kindle for 99 cents. You can pick them up by going to happyhorrorshowproductions.com and clicking on the Buy Short Stories tab. And Fanboy Planet, a website and podcast for all things geeky and amazing. Check out Fanboy Planet for your comics news, your movie news, TV news, and amazing interviews with industry insiders and artists. Fanboyplanet.com. In Coffee Over Suicide, a dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. New episodes every Wednesday and Friday wherever podcasts are found. Find out more at coffeeoversuicide.com. And Alice Frazier, co-host of the Bugle podcast and host of Tea with Alice, brings you a series of three genre-bending solo stand-up shows that explore the boundary between comedy and tragedy. They recorded back-to-back as a three-hour show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival with a binaural microphone, which creates an intensely immersive listening experience. Check out alicefrazier.com, alicefrazier.com. And that's with an S. And the Art Podcast with Rebecca Evans, now celebrating 1 year of the show with the Art Sunset Jam Saturday, October 26th. That is a live show. Details are at theartpodcasts.com, the Art Podcasts with an S. Tony McFadden, his 14th book is a gritty Australian noir. The murder of Jeremy Brooks pits small-town Australian PI Dan McGuinness against corporate greed and corruption. A Sydney surgeon hires Dan to find her husband's killer. The cops think it was a mugging gone bad. She thinks it was a hit. More info at TonyMcFadden.net/JB. TonyMcFadden.net/JB. And from Andy Bowman, every week on the Geek 101 podcast, Ariel and Andy get together to discuss, critique, review, and sometimes bicker about the latest in geek news and pop culture. Become a listener and join the conversation by listening to the Geek 101 podcast wherever you download podcasts. And Jerome Sullivan, he's a screenwriter. So calling on Hollywood, I urge you to go to jcsscreenplays.com to check out the briefs of his completed movie and television scripts, including a murder mystery, a sci-fi action thriller, a coming-of-age musical, a horror, a rom-com, and more. Visit jcsscreenplays.com. Thank you, everyone. Much appreciated.
Just go to patreon.com/comedyfilmnerds, and you can support our show, and you will be getting your rewards through December.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's get to some trailers, Graham. This is the Jungle Cruise, because we need another Disney movie based on a ride.
Yes. Yeah. Thank God. There is...
possesses unparalleled healing powers.
It's just irritating when it has the rock in it, because now I still may want to see it.
Stop. One of those guys, huh?
Yeah.
Just wanted you to know, this has been mislabeled.
Jesse Clemens?
Yep.
Putting these on
Jesse Clemens.
Oh my God,
Jesse Emily Blunt.
Yeah, Emily Blunt. Yeah.
He's shipping outlets.
Period piece.
Of all the jungle cruises you can take in the Amazon, this one is undoubtedly the cheapest.
So this looks like Disney version thrilling. Of Africa Queen.
Coming through. Look out!
He's always just the Rock, no matter
he
what
is.
No matter
is.
What he is.
Marauders.
He tries to feel like an everyman sometimes. But yeah, he can't buy it.
Just wish it didn't work so well.
It's true. It's true.
Ladies and gentlemen, the moment you've all been waiting for. The backside of water. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
We're headed upriver to Lagrimas de Cristal.
It looks better than it Haunted Mansion.
That is true. I'll give you that.
Not much
sure.
Of a feat, but...
My brother and I are looking for passage upriver.
Please go away.
They're actually using jokes from the actual ride, too.
If you believe in legends, you should believe in curses, too. You're going to beg me to turn back.
Well, I look forward to disappointing you.
10,000 to bring you there alive. Dead is 15,000.
Why should I pay more dead?
Dead, I'd have to carry you. Dead's a lot harder, lady. Here we go.
Put a little gravel in his voice. This is my character. I'm just talking a little lower.
Sorry, strong form.
Swim.
You booked a river cruise and you can't swim?
I mean,
swim?
I think we know The Rock isn't like a Brechtian theater actor. He doesn't have much brain. I gotta be honest. I'm not a huge Rock guy. I think he's very likable, but I just don't get much from him in these roles.
You know what you get from him? You get The Rock.
Yeah.
That's what you
pretty
get.
Much, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Okay.
And I know the movie's not meant to be super serious, but I can't help but think movies like this is, I mean, it's just pure capitalism. I mean, it's just all it is to me.
What I don't understand, and this is one thing that if I've been saying this for years about Disney. Disney has an amazing vault, and there are worthwhile things to remake in there. Like everything from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Swiss Family Robinson, even like obscure ones like The Last Flight of Noah's Ark. Where I remember it was, I think Elliot Gould was a pilot.
Oh, I love Elliot Gould.
They got caught off course, and then like they crash land on an island where there's Japanese soldiers who don't know the war is over. Like really crazy live action. No, remake these. Remake these. This would be interesting. I don't need a movie made on the Jungle Cruise. No. There's better things in the library that you already own.
Well, I think it's obvious why it's to co-op with a ride.
Absolutely,
it's solely a capitalist decision. Yes. I heard some critics make a good point. I can't remember who he was, but he made a great point. He said, "I don't know. It's like you said. Why are they remaking these properties? Why don't you remake one of the ones maybe we haven't heard of, or some of these movies that had great premises that Disney made a while ago when they used to take risks that didn't really get the either didn't put enough resources into it or something like that. I think if Disney really wanted to push the envelope, though, they'd out themselves and they would remake Songs of the South and bring their own and be held accountable for that, because I think they've kind of shoved it in the vault. But why don't you know? That's a good question. Why don't you make a movie for Splash Mountain, which is Songs of the South, because they've completely taken the Tar Baby and that stuff out of the ride and they still left it up. And I think or even a movie about the making of Songs of the South, because the mm-hmm. interesting thing is Disney went into that with the right intentions. He loved the Uncle Remus books, mm-hmm. And he had a real appreciation for it, but you know, it was just a disaster. I mean, it's yes. an absolute disaster, mm-hmm. and you can still find it on YouTube, and I recommend people do,
because
I think you watch that and watch Black Panther and tell me that, you know, Disney is the company that should be making some of this stuff, you know what I mean? And, like, and I think that this sort of, we see it with Disney, and I'm not to jump away from Jungle Cruise, but there's only so much I could say about it, but one thing about Disney that's kind of eye-popping is they have a terrible history with representation, whether you're talking about like Aladdin or any of those films. I mean, there's a lot of racist, stereotypical things going on there. Even mm-hmm. in Lion King, they use Triumph of the Will for some of the still images they drew from for the villain. I mean,
all that stuff disappeared for the live-action version. Yeah. All the more interesting things from the animated version.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh, wow. Now you've made it even worse.
Yeah, I think Disney never gets really held accountable. But this is a new thing I see a lot with film. It's not specifically Jungle Cruise, though. I haven't seen it. I'm sure they've slipped this in as they sort of use social awareness or you know, progressiveness in as a brand. And they try to shove it into a lot of their movies now. And I think it's kind of has mixed reviews. I think Disney is really responsible for a lot of it, but I think a lot of the studios are doing it, and they're like, this is the perfect horror movie for the Me Too generation. It's like, so you basically just took something that was kind of a big issue and diminished it to like a selling point on a movie, and you got to wonder why they do that. Yeah, and I think this is like going
through the library and like, oh, well, no, this can kind of tie into a the ride. We could refurbish the ride to then match the movie.
I mean, we make this joke all the time, but it still bears. I mean, like, what's next? Teacup the movie.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I can see it.
I'm getting too old for these massive teacups. You know, like. All right,
and the next one is The King's Man.
I know nothing about this.
Neither do I.
This is the third movie in the trilogy. Okay.
I thought the first one was pretty okay.
I'm curious to see how you guys are going to react to this one.
Throughout time, our people robbed, lied, and killed.
Oh, I know that voice.
Until one day, we found ourselves noblemen. But that nobility never came from chivalry. It came from being tough and ruthless.
Is that a Game of Thrones voice?
Is it Ralph Fiennes?
Yeah.
Real power is not found running off to war. Real power lies in understanding who it is you're truly fighting.
Batman.
That's what I was thinking.
And how they can be defeated.
Well, there are some Game of Thrones props in this movie.
I know you want to fight, but there are other ways of doing your duty. Come on.
So it's just a Kingsman prequel?
That's exactly what it is. It's a Kingsman prequel that I don't know if there's a time travel element to it or they're just flashing back a lot. None of the actual people in the other movies are in this.
That's what I noticed. I didn't see the guy who was in Rocketman.
That tall young kid is obviously... whoever what's-his-name is the head of the Kingsmen today.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What's that actor?
Colin Firth?
Yeah.
Yeah, Colin
Firth. So that's just young Colin Firth getting this is the birth of the Kingsmen.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. But it looks like a very, very convoluted way to get there.
It looks like it doesn't look like it has a lot of what I normally wouldn't even love a movie like Kingsman. I'm not a film snob. I watch a lot of older stuff. I stray away from a lot of the big budget Hollywood stuff, but I can find
those two sentences just completely contradicted themselves.
Tell me how.
Yeah, I'm not a film snob. I just don't watch anything
big budget
movies.
I shouldn't say I don't watch any of it. I can find value in some of it, but I have trouble really examining them closer than just being like, okay, that's entertaining. That's a throw. I think Scorsese was right. I think they are movies like this to me are amusement park rides. That doesn't mean they shouldn't exist. Just like, you know, amusement park rides should exist, but they tell you what's good and what's bad. They tell you when to laugh, when to cry, when to cheer. Mm-hmm. There is no real thought on the audience part except to sit back and enjoy it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I guess my reaction to a movie like this is I'm just like, okay, I mean, that's what is there to really say about that? I mean, it's, if anything, these prequels are just money grabs. And I mean, it's just a,
yeah, it's a thing that Roger Deakins said, I believe. He's like, where are the $40-50 million movies, the dramas that, you know, we've talked about that. There's the mid range drama.
Very true.
Where
they're
are
hard
they?
To find anymore.
There's the $10 million movie, mm-hmm. and then there's the $150 million movie, and there's not much in between.
No.
And they sprinkle some of them on the streaming services, and one out of every sixth one of them is decent.
Yeah, like this movie, you know, I didn't like the second one at all. I thought the first one was like, I didn't love it.
It was okay, I thought, right?
But this one, I'm like, I have no interest in seeing. I feel like this is just like, well, how can we milk the franchise and not use the people that we can't afford anymore?
What do they say? What do they say? Is it the Illuminati? Like, what are they? What's this global
conspiracy?
Yeah. Secret society. What is it?
Did you guys see the trailer for the new movie with Adam Sandler called Uncut Gems?
No, not yet.
Oh, man. I think that's going to be one of the movies of the year. I think it's going to give Joker a run for its money.
And really?
It played at the same festival. They both played at Venice. Joker won, but Uncut Gems was the one that was being arguably talked about more because it came in with a much smaller studio. But people are saying Adam Sandler's going to win the Oscar for this. He's wearing like two earrings. He's a Jewish diamond district dealer.
Really?
Super sleazy. He looks great. He looks like he packed some weight on. He's got a little goatee. I mean, it's really kind of shocking. He's got a big Star of David ring on his finger, and he's just fast talking, and I heard it has a lot of the energy of like the 70s Scorsese stuff, which is why I want to see that in Joker. It's like this new resurgence of that sort of thing Scorsese was doing, this just like very raw energy, and I think it's been missed.
All right. Well, we'll see it for sure.
Yeah.
All right, and we do want to mention again the store is closing out on December 12th. So we'll probably keep it open until about the 15th. So order anything you want before then. We will ship it out. And appreciate you guys going in the store. Like I said, anything you buy, there will be some free things in it. And a couple of you have bought the loot crates. It's not too late for the loot crates because you'll be charged for November and December. That's enough. And it'll be about a $50 charge because it'll be $25 each month. But there'll be a minimum of $100 to $200 worth of stuff in there, depending on your shirt size, because we're running low. But there's plenty of other stuff that we will put in there for you. So it is worth it, and it's a good way to kind of close things out with us and support the show. Thank you.
All right. Coming on DVD, we've got Crawl.
Yeah,
DVD
Crawl Blu-ray. Was that Killer Alligator movie. Yeah,
I wanted to see that because I heard it was good.
That's what I heard too. I'm like, oh, this looks awful, and then like, oh no, people are saying it's a really fun horror movie.
Well, then it's a perfect VOD.
Yeah,
agreed. I was going to check that one out.
Stuber, I think is that the
Rock and the guy from
it's not the Rock. It's the other Batista.
Oh, okay, so I mixed those up. How could I possibly mix
Kumail
those up?
Kumail Nanjiani driving around L.A.
He's like an Uber driver.
Yeah, it's wacky hijinks.
All right.
It's like a Lethal Weapon kind of thing where they're just two opposites paired up, though, right? Okay.
I wonder if I can
finish this on a plane.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll get along at the end and respect each other.
I bet they learn a lot about each other's backgrounds.
Because they learn nothing about each other. That's
they
what
just
I like.
Hate each other at the end.
Never changes.
The Art of Self-Defense, this one is the one that you really enjoyed.
This movie is super fun. It's intelligent, smart, indie comedy that has some great moments in it and great acting and great. Yeah, this movie was like one of the. This summer, there was a handful of sort of slower budget indie. There was this. There was Yesterday. There was Blinded by the Light. Those are like the three. And this one really was under the radar.
Right.
Yesterday and Blinded by the Light obviously were two mega bands where music was being played. But this one really, it's a dark comedy. I can't recommend it enough.
I've seen the trailer and I thought it looked great.
Yeah.
I'm not even a massive fan of Jesse Eisenberg. He's okay. I'm not a huge fan, but I thought the trailer looked very good. It reminded me of the old movie by Danny McBride. And if you guys fans of Danny McBride, he had a first film that was about where Danny McBride
foot
teaches. Is it like that? Or I mean, that's
the
what
fist
it,
foot way.
That one was way more campy, over the top.
Okay.
This is more dark.
I
mean, this
I like
is
that.
More. This is like Brick. Like a martial arts brick.
Oh, I wouldn't have gotten that from the trailer.
Me either. I kind of dug Brick. I kind of felt it was one of those dark indie comedies that's like you don't know how to feel. It puts you in this like weird, uncomfortable middle. And it's a good place to be.
High school noir. You don't see that very often.
Brick is, this is good.
Three from Hell. I think this is the Rob Zombie movie.
This is the third in the trilogy of Devil's Rejects and House of a Thousand Corpses.
Yeah, same characters. And I think one of them is his daughter, I believe.
His wife. Sherry Moon. You know, if I could say, I really do like House of a Thousand Corpses. I don't like it for the gore. I think it was just really effective when it came out. Hollywood had gotten way too safe with horror films, and that one just came out of nowhere and felt like a bad acid trip or something. That was really a haunting experience. I showed it to my wife recently, and she really enjoyed it. But I didn't like Devil's Rejects. I just couldn't get into it. They're wearing people's skin and raping people, and that's just not something I want to watch. Even if you're doing like an old spaghetti western thing, I have no interest in watching or trying to identify. And they did this thing where it's like you're not supposed to like them, but then they kind of made you feel like you should like them, and at the end they just get brutally murdered to Freebird. Sorry to spoil it, but yeah, I was not a fan of that at all. And then this third one...
That's okay. I don't think either one of us is going to watch.
The third one, though, I heard it's atrocious, and actually has the Night King from Game of Thrones in it as one of the main characters.
That would be hilarious.
It's bizarre. It's really strange. I think there's... I saw the trailers. Luchadors, the machine guns. It looks like a mess.
Wow.
It's like a mess.
All right. So the next movie is actually a straight-to-DVD release, Teen Titans Go versus Teen Titans. You know, this is interesting from an animation perspective because you had the original Teen Titans show, then you had Teen Titans Go, which was a comedic version of it, and then the movie was actually really funny, Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Yes,
remember we saw that?
I didn't see it.
It was a fun superhero parody. It was almost like Deadpool for kids. Like it had a lot of fun jokes in it. But from an animation perspective, this is a really interesting idea because you have – two vastly different animation styles. Mm-hmm. You have a cartoony, funny one and a more serious one, but they're putting them together and the characters like meet each other and fight. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, my son and I will definitely be watching that on demand.
I've heard good things about Teen Titans. I'll admit I'm not as versed on it, but I have heard good things.
It's Teen Titans is good, and then Teen Titans Go is also good, just in a different way because it's a comedy. But they do a lot of really meta stuff in it, like they'll argue. Like, oh, we got to fight Darkseid. Well, we should call Spider-Man. Spider-Man would never fight Darkseid.
Okay.
You know, separate.
That's funny.
Universes. And then there was even one where they started singing Happy Birthday and like, stop, we can't afford it.
if you don't mind me asking, because you're on the topic of animation and superheroes, I didn't see it. And like I said, I mean, I don't sneer my nose. I just don't get the time to watch. But I did hear that the end of the Spider-Verse or Enter the Spider-Verse, Spider-Man is phenomenal.
It's really good.
It's that good. Really good. I'm going to watch that. That looks great. You know?
Everyone's correct. And just be prepared. Some of the stuff is out of focus deliberately.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah.
The animation style looked really impressive.
Premiering this week, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. Speaking of money grabs, another one. The one I am excited about, though, is Zombieland Double Tap. This looks really fun, like a really fun sequel, even though it's 10 years later.
Well, the first one was super fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about this. When a comedy sequel comes out years later, it has a better chance of they found a really cool premise versus it's 18 months later and it's just a money grab and it's the same jokes. And
it's been churned out instantly.
Yeah, this feels like they went, hey, this would be cool.
And then Jojo Rabbit we have, which is the Hitler satire.
I don't know about that one.
You know, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm a big fan of the director. I can never pronounce his name right. Thor Ragnarok, What We Do in the Shadows.
The New Zealand
director.
He's very funny. But
yeah. Hunt for the Wilder People, which I loved, that indie movie. So I think this movie could kind of go either way. It could either miss the mark and just be like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing. Or it could be really funny and insightful.
I'm a believer of what, you know, I think it was Jean-Luc Godard who said if you wanted to make a movie about the Holocaust, it should really be nowadays just a woman in an office counting the bodies on a piece of paper, because I think that like it's very hard to do anything with the Holocaust now and do it properly, even a comedy. I think you need to be really not just good at comedy, but really understand the context of like fascism and the Holocaust to even do something like this. And I personally, I'm just not sure he's got the subtlety of it. I wouldn't even approach it, but I could be totally wrong on that. That one just sit a little weird with me. The poster alone, I think, is problematic. That's just me, though.
It's interesting because this isn't a Jewish or even American filmmaker. It's someone from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting where, like, what's his perspective and point of view going to be?
The movie looks like it's about a kid that's swept up in the Hitler Youth and then kind of starts to realize, oh, this isn't right.
Oh, it's his imaginary best friend is Hitler.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it's getting pretty good reviews for in festivals, so we'll see. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious to see it. The Lighthouse, this is that, remember we saw that trailer?
I want to see this.
That weird artsy horror movie that's in like black and white with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, where they're just in a lighthouse, and the trailer's like all these weird shots of like them in this claustrophobic area with like a Kraken and like
Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson stuck in a lighthouse, and then, you know, it looks almost like theater-esque, you know what I mean? It's like vaudevillian. It's got these, I heard he used the old lenses and the old cameras from the 30s. I think and it has this great German expressionist, like, I wouldn't say like Dr. Caligari, but like Nosferatu at least. Like, I just think it looks really interesting. And I don't even really like the director. I thought The Witch was okay. I thought it was a little dull. But I think The Lighthouse is going to be good.
All right.
Yeah, it looks fun. And then last is the Jay and Silent Bob reboot, which I didn't realize was getting made. But
this is this week that comes out?
Yeah. I didn't realize it got made. Kevin Smith's reboot of his own kind of like View Askew universe.
He crowdfunded this, didn't he?
I probably. I know the last couple he did for sure.
Yeah.
All right. That's our show.
Yeah. Kevin Rocca, where can people find your film? And also, I know you have an event coming up October 26th, so... if they want to go watch Revolution Televised, they would go to...
If you go to our YouTube channel, it's Right Brain Studios, Right spelled W-R-I-T-E. So if you go to Right Brain Studios, you can find our videos. All the episodes are up. And then on October 26th, we are going to be screening the film for a fundraiser to help us raise funds for the sequel. You know, we're grassroots filmmakers, and we are trying to, you know, we're hoping everybody could help out just a tiny little bit on the GoFundMe page so we can make a sequel, a real progressive documentary, because Hollywood's not going to make it. And we think that it's very much needed, that represents progressive values and shows a lot of these revolutionaries across the United States and activists that are fighting back against the media and the establishment and are just not given a platform. So we'd really appreciate it. The GoFundMe page is linked onto our YouTube channel. And on October 26th, we'll be doing a fundraiser at 1268 North Avenue, 50 Los Angeles, California, 90042, and it'll be $10 and you get a free drink. We're going to watch the film. There's going to be a panel, and a lot of progressives and Bernie people are going to be there. The Feel the Burn Club is co-hosting it with me, as well as the Bernie van will be there if you haven't seen that. And I invited Graham and Ron Placone, so hopefully they will be there too.
Yes, I should be there.
Making an appearance.
The Feel the Burn van, they were at the Jimmy Dore show. We just did a show there a Sunday at the Sycamore, and they had that crazy van.
It's so cool, yeah.
Which is great. And they're going out registering voters in like the Inland Empire and all these places where people typically don't vote, so it's pretty awesome.
I think they have a keg in there. I don't know if that's true, but I had heard that.
They got a lot of business in there, man.
That should be on the poster if you have a keg in there.
Yeah. That's right.
So check that out. Also, Ron Placone and I are doing the Progressive Comedy Tour in Australia. November 14th, we are in Melbourne. That show's almost sold out. The 15th, we're in Adelaide. The 17th, we're in Sydney. That show's getting close to sold out. And the 22nd, we are in Perth. So go to grahamelwood.com. We're also doing a Progressive Comedy Tour show in Los Angeles, December 14th at the Sycamore Tavern, which Ron and I each doing long sets. And you never know which fancy comedians will pop in to do sets that night. And that is 2 days after the Comedy Film Nerds 600th and final episode, December 12th at the Dynasty Typewriter.
Tickets still available.
Tickets still available. Go to dynastytypewriter.com or grahamelwood.com for the tour date.
Graham, will there be a reception afterwards?
Chris, that is a fantastic question. Yes, there will be a party afterwards. So if you buy a ticket to the show, you can hang out at the Dynasty afterwards and party with us, celebrate 10 years of doing this show and saying goodbye. And with a mass suicide.
I'm not being paid to say this. I want to buy tickets to both those events. They actually both sound great.
Oh, right on.
I'm definitely going to try to get out there.
Graham, if I've been late to the party and haven't bought an Earbuds DVD, could I get a free one with the ticket?
Oh, my God, yes. An Earbuds DVD will be included with your ticket price. So you can either buy one online now or just get a ticket to the show and you know you will get an Earbuds DVD.
That's a lot of choices.
I love how organic the whole thing is.
Yeah. It's so organic. It's so organic. Hey, Chris, are all major credit cards accepted on this website?
Not Amex, though, right?
PayPal?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I want to thank all the people that came out to the LA Comic Con over the weekend. I had a great panel with Comics on Comics, talked a lot about Joker. Some differing opinions, really interesting.
Oh, really?
And, you know, even dropped some trivia about the giant rats there because they were trying to do a little Easter egg about the Rat Catcher, which is some obscure DC villain.
Uh-huh.
And then I want to thank the people also for buying Long Ago and Far Away graphic novels at the Starburns booth. So thanks. It was really cool. Saw Rebecca and a couple
nice.
Other fans came by, and it was a really cool event.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. Well, thank you, folks, for listening to this episode. You can also see a further in-depth interview with Kevin about his film at Political Vigilante that'll be dropping in the next couple of days. Thanks for supporting the show. We appreciate Kevin. Thank you, Aaron, and everybody here at the All Things Comedy World headquarters.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, my friend. My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first.